This is Writer's Voice, airing on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
There's an enduring implausibility about the fact that people actually live up there where there are no trees. And the idea that they lived up there in a pre-technological setting is just dumbfounding.
That's Kevin Patterson talking about the people of the Arctic. They're the subject of his debut novel, Consumption. We'll talk to him in the first half of the show, and later on we'll talk with John Hanson Mitchell about Looking for Mr. Gilbert, the reimagined life of an African American. Dr. Kevin Patterson has been visiting the Arctic for many years and providing medical care to the Inuit communities of the region. Now he's come out with a debut novel that richly details the life of the Inuit as they transition from traditional nomadic existence to settlement and towns built for them by the Canadian government. Consumption tells a story of one family across three generations as they make this transition, the uneasy peace they make with modern society, and the connections and tensions between them and the Koblinooks, or whites, who come to work in the Arctic. Kevin Patterson spoke to Writer's Voice from his clinic in Canada last month. Now, you're a physician, and you spent some time, in fact, we're talking to you right now in your hospital in British Columbia.
Yeah, Duncan, on the southern tip of Vancouver Island.
And you spent some time working as a doctor in the Arctic.
Yeah, I've been working up there for the last 14 years or so. I go there back and forth many times a year. I'll be up there again in about 3 weeks. I was there as a family doctor initially, and then subsequently I've been going up there as an internist for the last half dozen years or so.
Wow. And so say, why did you first start going up there? And also then tell us how your experience there led to the writing of this novel, Consumption.
I went up there because I was fascinated by the idea of edges. My attention was always drawn in my reading and my traveling to places where people lived on the very margins of the population centers of the cultures and the societies, and the North represents that for me. You know, there's an enduring implausibility about the fact that people actually live up there where there are no trees, and the idea that they lived up there in a pre-technological setting is just dumbfounding. Difficulty. I mean, we're primates. You know, we're forest dwellers, and apes climb down from the trees. And the idea that people live in the Arctic, where the tallest plant is the dwarf willow that grows at about mid ankle height, is counterintuitive on every level. The people used to use frozen fish tied together as sled runners for their sleds when they couldn't find driftwood. I'm amazed by that, and I love what that says about human ingenuity and endurance and resilience. And at the same time, I just can't really believe that that ever happened, even after going up there for a decade and a half now. And so that's been the initial and the enduring appeal of the Arctic, I think. And how it's affected me is, I guess I've just come to understand that people, when pushed, can do anything.
And how has that impacted you personally?
Well, you know, I suppose we all have trouble in our lives, but if one is tempted to think that a particular challenge on a given day is substantial, one might just reflect on the prospect of raising a family on the barren lands, and everything might be put into context a little bit. I suppose that would be the best answer I could give you.
And you know, it does seem that they have, that in many ways they were quite successful in being able to live without trees, that is, able to live in a very healthy kind of a life that was there, and somewhat less successful as they've moved further away from it. Is that true?
Well, I think it's important not to over-romanticize the lives of hunter-gatherers. You know, that's a temptation for most of us, and anyone who's chafed against the confines of buildings and houses and civilization and whatnot has been tempted, I think, to idealize that life. In fact, you know, about half of their kids died. And my suspicion is that every one of those deaths occasioned just as much agony and heartbreak on the part of the parents as any of our children's death would occasion in us. So, no, I think it was a very difficult and tough life, and really that's why when they had the opportunity to move into settled communities, they've chosen to. And, you know, I mean, there's nothing really to stop someone from going back out on the land right now and trying to pursue that life again, and nobody does because of good reasons. Having said that, the challenges of change and of affluence are potent too, and a little bit more slippery to contend with. You know, when there's not enough food around, you try really, really hard to find some caribou or some seals to hunt, and that's a more straightforward problem. The problem of an excess of distractions and excessive amount of calories available to us all, you know, without expending any effort to obtain them, that's harder to contend with. You know, it should be as simple as eating a little bit less and giving the television a rest and staying away from the internet porn. But most of us have trouble limiting our intake of these sorts of things. And so it's a more interesting problem from a writer's point of view, and a thornier problem, I think, from a cultural point of view.
Well, all these transitions, the confrontations between the old and the new, was very much the stuff of your novel Consumption. It's a story of a family that seems to embody the changes that we've just been talking about, that the Inuit people have been going through from their traditional hunter-gatherer life and then their settlement in towns that were built for them by the Canadian government. There's your protagonist, Victoria, who was taken from her parents at the age of 10 when she tested positive for active TB and was sent to, was it Winnipeg for treatment?
Initially Winnipeg, but up to the Clear Lake Sanatorium, which is in the Paw, which is perhaps 350 miles north of Winnipeg, right in the boreal forest, where most of the indigenous peoples were Cree. That's where most of the Inuit were treated. I think the idea was that it was closer to the Arctic. It might be more comfortable for them than an urban setting.
Give us a brief picture of the kind of daily life, for example, that Victoria's father, Emo, lived. I mean, she's taken from her parents, Winnie and Emo, who are living a very traditional life. What would a typical day for him have been like at the time that she was taken away?
Well, the last of the Inuit to come in off the land did so in the late 1960s. But beginning in the early 1950s to the late 1960s, there was this steady exodus from the land. And during that period, the people who were still on the land lived a migratory life, which over time came to involve the settlements more and more. It was less like flipping a switch and more of a continuum, I think, where people went from spending most of a year at a time out on the land and coming into the Hudson Bay Company trading posts to buy rifle ammunition and sewing needles, perhaps once or twice a year. That might have been the way they lived in the 20s or the 30s. And then by the 50s, they were large portions of the population, anyway, were in a kind of orbit around the different Hudson Bay Company posts. And even out on the land, they were eating a lot of bannock, which is, you know, made with flour. So that required fairly regular involvement with the trading posts. What prompted that was, beginning in the 1920s or so, the Arctic fox trade became increasingly important. There was quite a fashion for the white fox fur coats. And so the Inuit hunters began hunting the fox more and more, and then trading those fox skins in at the Hudson Bay posts for flour and supplies and whatnot. And that began an involvement with the settlements that progressed over the next 30 years or so until they were actually living in the settlements more or less full-time. But before settling in the settlements full-time, what a day consisted of was a lot of movement. You know, the hunters followed the caribou, and the caribou migrate more or less relentlessly. The land is so, the forage on the land is so thin that just a few caribou in a river valley can deplete the forage within a, you know, a short number of days. And so there's more or less constant movement, and as a result, anybody that depends upon the caribou has to move as well. And that relentless movement, of course, affects how much you can own, and because what you can own is limited to what you can carry, either on your back or on the dog sleds. And you know, the other preoccupation of the Inuit prior to settlement was the weather. The weather was a constant menace, and to be caught out in a blizzard and unable to find shelter was tantamount to a death sentence, I think. And so they were quite careful to assess the weather every morning and only travel if they thought the weather would be good. They lived in igloos, of course, throughout the winter, and when the weather was bad, they spent a lot of time sitting in their igloos and telling stories and playing games, and the women worked on their sewing. Survival was really a function of the incredible boots that the Inuit women would make, which were completely waterproof, even though originally they were sewn with bone needles, and they used as thread, they used the esophaguses of seagulls to sew the boots together. And notwithstanding this quite limited tools, the stitching was so fine that the hunters could stand in up to their knees in the water without getting any moisture in at all, which of course would be equal to more or less instant frostbite, and in the Arctic, serious frostbite and leads to gangrene pretty quickly, and again it's a death sentence. So these were the concerns of the Inuit. Following the game, keeping the clothing in good repair, and trying to keep everybody entertained.
Well, that's a beautiful description, and those boots were also some of them were very beautifully done as well, with great decorative designs.
The beadwork that is a feature of the Dene or Chipewyan people further to the west isn't so much part of the tradition of the Inuit. The Inuit, certainly, there is ornament in the boots, particularly the women's boots. The men's boots are more severe, but there's a stark beauty about them, too. There's, you know, contrasting patterns between the Ugjuk, which is a bearded seal that has quite a black skin, and that's used as the sole and the sort of the foot part of the boot, and the upper part of the boot that goes up to the knee can be caribou, can be ringed seal, but different patterns are often made by alternating dark fur and light fur. No, there's a real beauty to it, and I find the beauty quite a bit more potent for its lack of ornamentation. You know, it's a real, really simple and gorgeous design aesthetic that guides them.
And have you also learned the Inuit language?
Inuktitut's a difficult language. I know, I don't know, 100 words or 200 words or so. I can ask people if it hurts when I take a deep breath and that sort of thing, but I can't have a conversation with it. I'm disappointed about that. The current generation of Kablunaks, of Southerners who travel up there, are marked by their disinclination to learn English. I suppose that has to do with, you know, our presumption that the whole world knows English, I suppose. The older priests all learned Inuktitut and are held in higher esteem as a consequence. There's a priest up in Repulse Bay, for instance, who's 84 years old and has been up there since 1950. And he thinks and dreams in Inuktitut and delivers his masses in Inuktitut. And the old people say his Inuktitut is unaccented and actually of a complexity and sophistication that a lot of the young Inuit don't even have anymore in their Inuktitut because they, like us, spend so much time watching music videos.
He sounds like the priest in your book.
Yeah, he's the fairly transparently the model for Bernard. His name isn't Bernard, but that's about the only difference.
That's great. Now, Victoria, back to the book, Consumption, and we are talking with the author, Kevin Patterson, Dr. Kevin Patterson. He is the author of Consumption. Victoria comes back to the community that's changed. She has spent something like 6 or 7 years away. You've described a little bit about what's happened in her absence, but she's also changed profoundly. She doesn't even speak her native language as fluently as she did before, and she's got a fairly marginal position in her own community.
Mm-hmm. This was actually a fate that befell much of a whole generation of Inuit children. There was a tuberculosis epidemic among the Inuit in the 1950s. It had been a serious problem for many decades before then, but it became a crisis as the cash economy grew and people began to spend more and more time congregating around the trading posts, and that gave opportunity for the tuberculosis bacteria to spread much more easily. Normally, hunting-gathering peoples don't have a lot of problems with transmissible infections because they live in small bands that are widely dispersed, and the epidemics don't have a lot of trouble spreading between the different bands. But with the evolution of the cash economy, that changed. At one point or another in the 1950s, about 40%, I think, of Inuit children had been evacuated to the south for treatment of their tuberculosis. And that's provided a sort of a rupture to the transmission of the traditions and skills of the Inuit. The task of navigating and hunting on the land is so complex and so skill intensive and so dependent upon a very complex technology of harpoons and trapping and hunting techniques, that to take a boy away from his father, for instance, at the age of 8 and return him at 16, well, at that point he might as well have no relation to his father, because at 16 he's supposed to be one of the principal hunters in the group, and that won't be possible. So the tuberculosis epidemic really catalyzed the movement of the people into the communities, because there was this disjunction between what they had been, what the young people had known, and what they knew now. And Victoria's experience is intended to be representative of that whole generation.
Your book also explores goes fairly deeply into the interrelationships between the whites. How do you pronounce the name Kablunuk?
Kablunuk, yeah, it's a good word. The kablu means short wiry hair, particularly the hair of the eyebrow, and nauk means abdomen. And when the New England whalers appeared in Hudson Bay in the 1880s, the Inuit were very, very impressed with how hirsute they were. And so forever after, white people, men and women, are known for our hairy bellies, our hairy abdomens. And it's a witty term for us all, I think.
So there's a lot about the relationship between the Inuit and the hairy bellies.
Yes.
Victoria meets and marries a white Canadian, Robertson, and he's a fairly complex figure. On the one hand, I felt sorry for him because he's so clearly on the losing side of his marriage, but he's also an opportunist who, in the eyes of some of the Inuits in the community, is complicit in destroying the last vestiges of their traditional community. How do you see this character Robertson?
Well, that's exactly. I think you've summarized him nicely. It's interesting. The people who are drawn to traditional societies and marginal existences, people like me, have a huge hand in furthering their destruction. It's like tourists who want to go to the Andaman Islands to visit the last of the hunting gathering tribes that live there, have to acknowledge that their very act of going there and witnessing these people will change those people utterly. And that's the tragedy. The people that are most drawn to and perhaps the most affectionate of traditional peoples need to understand that their participation in their lives is an agent of change. And that's Robertson's situation. I mean, he's no innocent. It's true that he's motivated by, you know, he ends up working for a diamond mining outfit, and diamond mining is a very big deal in the Canadian Arctic right now. It's sort of the source of optimism among the financiers up there anyway, and is, you know, generating several billion dollars a year in trade. And Robertson's idea is that he wants to participate in that, but he's pretty self-interested. And so his actions create a lot of controversy within his community.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to reveal too much of the book, but in this diamond mine, he kind of sows the seeds also of his own destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a tension that is created in the family between Victoria, who seems to really straddle two worlds. On the one hand, she's got this husband, Robertson, who's white, and on the other, her elder son, Pelusi, really wants to go back to the old ways. Talk about Pelusi. Tell us about him.
Pelusi's instinct is towards that of his mother and his grandfather in particular are the people that he gravitates toward. And he doesn't identify with his father much at all. The idea of neo-traditionalism is one that creeps up in lots of traditional societies as they are undergoing acculturation. We've seen it in the Pacific Islanders with attempts to revive the traditional sailing canoes and using the traditional methods of navigation in an obvious way, the revival of the traditional tattooing arts that you see, especially among the Maori in New Zealand and the Marquesans and the Hawaiians as well, are all expressions of this. In among the Inuit, it's revolved around a revival, I think, of the dog sledding tradition, and there are more dog teams up there now than there were a few years ago. But really, you know, the neo-traditionalism is in itself a marker of acculturation, you know, to start reaching for and trying to recapture in such a direct way the old traditions is a clear declaration that they're gone. And that's the insight that Pelusi comes to over the course of the book, that simply the force of his longing for the land and the extent to which he nostalgizes the land and romanticizes the land is the most definitive proof that he is not of the land the way that his grandfather was. The old men, the old hunters, and the old women, they didn't romanticize the land that way. They saw the world as hard, and they saw the land as a thing to be struggled with constantly. And we do romanticize it, and the reason we romanticize it is because we're so far from it.
And one of the figures that romanticizes it is a white Canadian who embodies, in some ways, Robertson's polar opposite, and that's Penny. She's the teacher who goes native.
Yeah. Well, Penny's a romantic. There's no doubt about it. She's drawn to the Arctic for quixotic reasons and falls in love with it and tries to, she learns how to run a dog team and learns how to hunt. And I've known actually a few women up in the Arctic who have done just this, and I find them very compelling and fascinating characters.
Women more so than men?
Well, the ones that draw your attention are the women, or the ones that draw my attention are the women. But I'm not sure why that is. I think when I cast my mind back and try and think of the Kablunaks I've known that have really gotten into dog teaming, most of them do seem to be women, and that's an interesting thing that I can't quite explain.
Now, this community of characters in your novel Consumption, and we are talking with the author, Kevin Patterson, this community of characters is really wonderful. They're all very fully realized. And one of them, the doctor, Balthazar, is another very complex character. The implication seems to be that he's not a very competent doctor. He's responsible for the loss of Victoria's fourth child, a stillbirth, and also through no real fault of his own, her second daughter as well. And he also becomes addicted to drugs. Why did you, a doctor yourself, make this character so hapless?
Well, you know, there have been a lot of doctors who have written about doctors in the Arctic, and they often do tend to get drawn as heroic, quasi-godlike creatures off whom shine golden rays of brilliance and benevolence. And those books are mostly pretty dull. The interesting characters are always, in my view, messed up in some important way. And certainly Balthazar is messed up in a lot of important ways, not least of which is his drug use, although it's a contained drug use, and he has sort of a negotiation with the world or with himself that allows it and justifies it, which I don't for a second, but he does. And you're right, he is hapless, but beyond his haplessness and his mistakes, he blames himself for unhappy outcomes probably far more than he ought to, or than a lot of people would if they looked at situations objectively. But that's in his character, and that's part of the burden that he carries, and that's part of what handicaps him, I suppose, too, as a physician, is the extent to which he blames himself for the tragedies that exist around him. I mean, the fourth child dies of shoulder dystocia, which is a disaster in a facility without an obstetrician, but he cuts himself no slack, and that's his pattern, and that's how he consumes himself.
And he also provides a kind of narrative thread. What's the role of this medical diary that he's keeping, in which he contemplates the diseases that afflict both natives and then also modern people, or people who are modernizing as well as modern?
He's sort of the bookkeeper of the whole community. He chronicles in his medical narrative the physical and tangible correlates of the changes in worldview and philosophy and heart that everyone else is acting out in the course of the dramatic arch of the book. And, you know, he's very interested in the way people's change when they move from a traditional hunter-gathering society where they struggle with starvation and trauma, particularly homicide, and exposure, to a completely different sort of pathologies that they develop as they move into communities and they start to get fat and develop diabetes and cancer and heart disease. And these two ideas are twisted around one another over the course of the book, emphasizing the fact that this is a trajectory with a fairly defined and quite tragic path that ends where we are, and ultimately the problems of the Inuit are not particular to them. The problems of the Inuit are, over time, increasingly our problems. And these ideas, like the disaffection of the young from the elderly and the obsolescence of the skills and experience of mature adults, these are our problems, too.
Kevin Patterson, it's just been delightful to talk to you here, mostly about your wonderful novel, Consumption, a really rich portrayal of the Inuit and the the hairy bellies who go up to be part of the life up there. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And that was Kevin Patterson. His debut novel is Consumption. It's about the collision between the old and the new in an Inuit community in the Canadian Arctic. It was published in 2007 by Doubleday Press. On Monday, we'll have up on our website both the podcast of this show as well as a web-only extra about Patterson's work in Afghanistan with refugees there. You'll also find a link to his article about that work, Talk to Me Like My Father. It appeared in Mother Jones last year. That's at writersvoice.net. Next up, John Hanson Mitchell and Looking for Mr. Gilbert, The Reimagined Life of an African American. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the mid-1970s, my guest, John Hanson Mitchell, discovered over 2,000 antique glass plate negatives in the attic of an old estate in Massachusetts. At the time, he believed the photographs to be the work of William Brewster, the 19th-century ornithologist and conservationist. But as a result of a tip from a Harvard research assistant, Mitchell came to believe that the plates were not the work of Brewster, but of his assistant, a little-known African-American named Robert Alexander Gilbert. Mitchell has been turning his unique and penetrating lens on the pleasures of place and the natural world since 1985. His books range from, to give an incomplete list, Ceremonial Time, which examines the history of 1 square mile of ground from 15,000 years ago to the present, Walking Towards Walden, A Pilgrimage in Search of Place, to his field guide to your own backyard, as well as a new book we hope to get him into Writer's Voice to talk about later in the year, The Rose Cafe. He's the editor of the award-winning magazine Sanctuary, published by the Massachusetts Audubon Society, and a co-author of The Nature of Massachusetts. Writer's Voice talked to Mitchell about Looking for Mr. Gilbert, The Reimagined Life of an African American, in 2005, and we're airing it again now in honor of African American History Month. I asked John Hanson Mitchell what prompted him to unravel the mystery of this man, Mr. Gilbert, and whether he was in fact convinced, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that the glass plates of photographs that Mitchell had found were in fact produced by the subject of his book.
Well, I am now. I wasn't when I started. I mean, I was doing a book on landscape, land use, and I was collecting old photographs of the New England landscape, and I was told these plates were up there in the attic. And we published the book, and at a little event after, after the book was published, a little book event, this odd character in a cowboy hat wandered up to me and asked if I wrote the captions for the photographs. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, that they were not taken by William Brewster. They were taken by his assistant, his manservant, really, Robert A. Gilbert. And this man was a librarian at Harvard, at the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard, where some of the other Brewster material is stored. And he said he had evidence that these plates were actually taken by Gilbert. And that's what got me started on this campaign. I tried to set out to prove it, and I'm pretty sure he did it. I'm positive. I know he did at least some. I found some prints and some negatives that were signed by Robert A. Gilbert, and so I had about 4 or 5 of those. I found these obvious examples of Gilbert's work, And then I found also photographs. I mean, William Brewster took photographs too. They were both working together. It's not like Brewster was trying to cheat this guy. In fact, they were friends in a bizarre way, you know, master-servant relationship. But anyway, I found photos that were taken by Brewster at a time when Gilbert wasn't there. So I came to recognize, after, you know, looking at hundreds of these, I came to recognize the styles of these two men. And it's pretty obvious. I mean, Brewster was a straight-on sort of scientific recorder of biological facts, you know, nests of birds' eggs and birds' holes in trees and owls, if he could find them, and strange phenomena of natural history and that sort of thing. Whereas Gilbert had a far more poetic style. He seemed to favor landscapes and rivers and streams. He tended toward unique visions, Gilbert did, the black man did, whereas I mean, I found pictures by Brewster. You don't even know what they're really about. They're like pictures of brush. And probably somewhere buried in the brush there is a bird, you know. But, you know, he didn't seem to have the eye that Mr. Gilbert had.
So Gilbert had a sense of the dramatic as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, that was a pretty unusual relationship from a number of points of view. Not only was it unusual for Gilbert to be a photographer, but also to be in the position that he was. I wonder if you could just say something very briefly about Gilbert's background, and then I have some more questions about the relationship between the two
mm-hmm.
men.
Yeah, well, he was born in about 1869, and he was, of course, born free. That's after the war. He was born in Natural Bridge, Virginia, just south of Lexington. The people over there were not big slaveholders. I mean, they did have slaves, but there were actually a lot of freeborn blacks living over there. And I suspect, I'm reading the images. I have an image of his father. And, you know, it's a portrait. He sure looks freeborn to me. And if he wasn't, I wouldn't want to be this guy's master. He looked like a powerful, independent figure.
You call him the Old King. Is that
the
your
old
name?
Old King, yeah.
Is that your name for him?
Yeah, it kind of fits, but that's my term. He was born in this semi-liberated region of the South, poverty-stricken nonetheless. It was very rural. He was educated. There's a huge irony in the fact that Stonewall Jackson, you know, the Confederate general, was from Lexington, a great defender of slavery, and yet, contrary to Virginia law, he believed slaves should be taught to read. And this is not so that they could gain their freedom, but so that they could read the Bible. He was a religious fanatic. So he had these schools. He established these schools in Lexington. And Gilbert went to school in Lexington. And by sixth grade, he could read and write. Now, there was no further education after that in Lexington. And he moved on to Lynchburg, where he probably completed high school. And then, as did many blacks in that period, this is around 1886, he took the train north to Boston, and that's where he sort of started his career.
You talk about Gilbert as being good at role-playing, that as a black man in America, he had to be. Yet he also comes across as a fairly consistent figure, sober, meticulous, capable. And the nature of his relationship with Brewster also seems to reflect that. And you say also on page 10, I have a quote here, if I can read it. The souls of these two men, master and servant, one white and born with a proverbial silver spoon in his mouth, one black and from humble beginnings, had by some fluke of fate or history been forged in the same smithy. So I wonder if you could talk about the roles that Gilbert played and also the nature of the relationship between Brewster and him and how it reflected the class and race relations of the time and how it was different. It's kind of a big question.
Yeah, it's a good question. There is this, what's actually a literary tradition of the master-servant relationship, you know, where you have the wise servant and the bumbling master. there's a little bit of that in here, but there's this really unique twist in that Brewster, as I pointed out, or you pointed out there, he's a rich white man, a member of the Brahmin class. Robert A. Gilbert is, you know, a newcomer from the American South, only a few years in Boston. He's the servant. He obeys what Brewster says. Presumably in the beginning, he's, you know, yes sir, no sir. But he also, Gilbert, was ambitious, and he was smart. He was really smart, and he was bent on self-improvement. I think he's kind of an Emersonian figure, you know, self-reliance. I think he was even exposed to Emerson. The real twist in here is that Brewster was a Brahmin, and the Boston Brahmins, the rich Bostonians, they were working hard at abolition. They, Dorothy West, the novelist, said in one of her books, "You're Bostonian of the proper sort. Never did mind a black face beside them on the trolley, provided they were properly dressed." They were a tolerant group. Blacks went to Harvard, you know. However, you still see in the notes and the diaries of other people who knew Brewster and Gilbert, you learn that Gilbert's black. There are things like Brewster's colored friend, Gilbert, the wise colored factotum of Mr., you know, colored this, colored that. And yet, in the 25 years of journals and notes and field diaries of Mr. Brewster, there's no way you would know that Gilbert's black. Camping together, they're traveling together, they're looking at birds together, they're taking notes together, they're working in the museum together. No reference to his race.
So they're really more than master-servant.
Well, eventually, they're friends. I mean, even the references from other people say, Brewster's good friend, the colored man. He always colored from other people, you know. But the other people accepted him. He would be there. I mean, there's a photograph it's actually on the cover of the book and on the inside of a group of white people standing up in a lodge somewhere place in the North Country, and there are obviously servants there. They're in they're white, but they're wearing aprons, you know.
Yeah.
Well, standing with them is Robert A. Gilbert,
and he's not dressed with an apron.
He has no apron. He's dressed in a black suit and a white shirt and a tie. that was one of the images that set me off on this quest. I that's one of the first pictures I found, and I always wondered, even before this cowboy guy arrived, I wonder who is this black man up here in the North Woods? What's his story?
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're speaking with John Hanson Mitchell, author of Looking for Mr. Gilbert, The Reimagined Life of an African American. So do you think he was playing a role with Brewster, or do you think that as time, he may have started out that way, but as time went on, he was able to really be himself?
I think with Brewster, he probably always maintained a certain formality. Brewster himself was a very friendly guy, but he was a formal Brahmin type, you know?
Mm-hmm.
However, here's the thing. Mr. Gilbert, he had two roles. Among the white society, he was Brewster's man. Well, in the black community in Cambridge, he was one of the most respected figures. He was a known entity, a churchman, a skilled pianist, known to be the associate of the famous Mr. William Brewster, you know, traveling in white company, off to France, off to England, off to the North Woods, out to Lancaster, to the big estates of the Thayer family. I mean, he was all over and highly respected. I mean, I met older black people in the community in Cambridge who remember him. And he was ever the formal, almost inscrutable character, apparently. Very upright. He was just a steady, solid, or stolid even, figure, I think.
Yet at the end of, I guess after Brewster died, he did seem to take on a role that was different.
Yes.
Than who he really was. I wonder
right.
if you could say something about that, and why do you think he did that?
I think what happened was the white society changed. a little bit. You know, when he was with Brewster, Brewster died in 1919. And as long as Brewster was alive, Gilbert was traveling in these enlightened circles. You know, all of Brewster's friends were, you know, educated people. They were professors, and they were interested in natural history, and they were out in the field a lot. And they accepted Mr. Gilbert. After Brewster died, Gilbert went over to the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard, and he was accepted there, but nobody knew much about him. You know, Gilbert himself, used to joke. He said he just came along with the Brewster collection of bird, you know. There was a man there at the museum, Thomas Barber, who sort of liked everybody, and he had traveled all over the world. You know, he was much less of a racist than some of the other people that might have been hanging around the Museum of Comparative Zoology at the time. But still, Gilbert's not Gilbert anymore. He's lost that association, and I think slowly he resumed that servant role, I think, as he aged, you know. And then, you know, he left the museum for a few years, and when he came back, he needed the museum even more. And I just think he began to walk a little more slowly. And now, mind you, I have to say that my sources on this are all white people.
I see.
You talk to black people, and he had not lost a modicum. He hadn't lost an inch of his aristocratic carriage. you know what I mean?
That's so interesting, because really what you're saying is that With Brewster there to kind of, you know, define him as a human being, he could be who he was. That role-playing could fall away. But once Brewster was gone, given the racism of American society, then there had to be a bifurcation again.
Right. Yeah, he went back to his old role, you know, of black man. And black man in white society. And yet, and you know, Boston was an enlightened city. I mean, if you're going to be a black person in 1900, the best place you could be was Boston. Negro paradise, it was known of as in the South. You know, he would have heard of it. But, you know, doesn't mean there wasn't this sort of undercurrent of racism in Boston. In fact, there was. The schools were not, they were legally integrated, but in fact, you know, just because of the mix of the neighborhoods that were black schools and white schools, and things really went downhill after 1927. You know, the sort of decline of the Brahmin class and the rise of the Irish, who were at one point sort of in competition with the blacks. Also, there was a new crop of black people coming up about 1910, there was a terrible boll weevil infestation in the South, and you get this mass exodus, and these sort of field hands were coming up to Boston. They couldn't read or write, and they were country people, you know, and they were loud, and they didn't give a damn about anything, you know, and there was real racism against them, even from the established black community. Boston had this old established black community that was not quite equal to the white community, but not far removed. I mean, it had its sort of separate but equal societies, you know. And they had cotillions, and they had their the Jack and Jill clubs, you know. And they were a perfect reflection of white society. But then come in these other types, you know. I think the established blacks knew that they were on thin ice, and they were afraid that these newcomers were going to undermine their position. Gilbert and Brewster are the kind of the main stem rivers, but there are a lot of tributaries that, you know, including my search for this man, that come in. And part of it is this, you know, African-American history, and specifically Boston African-American history, which is unique to the United States as far as I can tell.
Yeah, that was due to, you kind of put it down to both the religious roots as well as the roots of transcendentalism, is that right? Or that whole kind of reformist. I wonder if you could talk about those. Were they really two separate streams, or did they feed into each other in this, kind of the New England character?
Well, transcendentalism actually has its roots in Europe, But I think that the Puritan sort of mindset, Puritans get a bad rap, you know. I mean, they had slaves, but they didn't like to think of them as slaves. They believed in good work, you know. Right. You know, the richest of the Puritans thought of themselves as servants. And so the fact that they have a slave, he or she is doing the same work they are. And, in Boston, in Puritan Boston, a slave, quote, could sue the master for mistreatment. They could buy their independence. It's a little like an indentured servant. Only better than an indentured servant had to work for a number of years. If you got some money as a slave, you could buy your freedom the next day. They were allowed to own and sell land. They could marry. They didn't want to. The Puritans wouldn't split up families. From the very beginning, blacks had an advantage in Boston. This is, I'm talking about 17th century now, you know,
right.
1670s. There was a black, in fact, it's on Beacon Hill, it's called New Guinea, and it was a freeborn blacks living there. So it was an entirely different culture, and I think that history, coupled with this transcendental independence and, the intellectual community within Boston, I just think, and mainly abolitionists. I mean, the abolitionist movement got its roots in that Puritan ethic.
You start every chapter with a photo by Gilbert, I presume, and a quote. And you say that the camera is an alchemist's mortar and pestle or a shaman's drum. I wonder what you mean by that.
Well, I'm taking this from photographic criticism. But the current thinking and the current argument or debate is the photograph really a record? And the way people are looking at it is that the photograph it's a fiction. It's snatched out of this continuum of time. You know, you have this flow of events. The camera comes in, it stops one of those events, it pulls it out, and yet time flows on without that singular image. And, you know, what happens before you take the photo and what happens after, you don't know anything about it, and it's open to any kind of interpretation. Well, during, you know, rituals, during the shaman's ritual, you can do the same thing. You know, you sort of halt the normal flux of time, and you extract from one thing something else. Since, you know, the full story of Mr. Gilbert is not known, really. Well known as he was, he's still a black man living in America, you know, and so his life has kind of fallen through the cracks. It's an invisible history, his life. I mean, it's hard to dig out. So I use that idea of the photograph as a metaphor for this man's life. Some of those plates, some of those glass plate negatives, I dare say had never been printed. And you put them in this development bath, and then you put the paper in the development bath. It's just a white piece of paper. And then slowly, as you can watch, you can see this, you know, in the red ghostly light of the dark room, this image slowly emerges out of nothingness, you know. It comes up sharper and sharper and darker and darker up into the 20th century. You know, it's something snapped. It's a frozen moment from 1898, Concord River, you know. And there it is in our time. Almost a mystic experience. And so that, too, caused me to kind of think of this magical quality of photographs.
Right, like a shaman conjuring up visions.
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
And stopping time and traveling freely in time.
That's some of the most marvelous passages in your book, and yet you still seem to have a kind of ambivalent attitude about the process, because you have numerous quotes that talk about how, well, like, for example, Richard Avedon, all photographs are accurate, none of them is the truth. You say that a photo only tells you externalities, and yet you also say that it was through the images that you found the man. So it seems to me that what you're really saying there is you did find some truth.
What I mean by that is that I was able to, I was able to explore the life of this man by, you know, it's a reimagined life. It's like an offshoot of the so-called reality of the photo. If I'd done a book about what I really know about Mr. Gilbert, it would have been about 20 pages.
Huh.
You know, born probably in Natural Bridge, Virginia in 1869, went to school probably in Lynchburg in blah, 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 came to Boston certainly in 1896, I think we have that on record, married Anna Scott, such and such a date. The bare facts of this man's life. And then, you know, you dig into the journals of Mr. Brewster, and you see references all throughout to Gilbert. But all they are is, Gilbert saw a wren today, or Gilbert took the bags up to Bethel, Maine today, and I shall meet him later on the such-and-such train. There's nothing. It's just the skeleton of a life. And the photographs, through the metaphor presented by these haunting, I think, haunting images of landscapes, and, you know, I was able to tell a fuller story of this guy.
So did you reach a point where you really felt that this man inhabited your life, or vice versa, that you inhabited
absolutely. His? Uh-huh. Oh, absolutely. It was just total immersion in this period of history and this singular, elusive, enigmatic character. We still don't know who he was.
John Hanson Mitchell's book is Looking for Mr. Gilbert, The Reimagined Life of an African American. It was published by Shoemaker and Hoard in 2005. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Please join us next week for a penetrating look at the downside of internet culture. We talk with Lee Siegel about his new book, Against the Machine. To find out more about Writer's Voice and upcoming authors at our website, go to writersvoice.net. You can also find links there to authors' books, and you can leave your comments, listen to, or download past shows. That's all at writersvoice.net, and we get our podcasts up there by Mondays after the Friday of our first airing here on WMUA. Thanks for listening. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.